From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Mercedes-Benz, design, performance, slave labor. That's an ad that appeared, a full-page ad that appeared in the New York Times this week. Another ad, full-page in papers, the assembly lines Ford would like to forget, and a picture of people in concentration camp uniforms. Today, negotiations begin in Washington between Holocaust survivors who were slave laborers and the corporations they worked for, like Daimler Chrysler and Mercedes-Benz and Bayer. Also, a debate over whether the U.S. should sign the nuclear test ban treaty, and another look at South Korea and the Korean War. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan presented a sweeping plan yesterday for the United Nations to take full control of East Timor and guide the territory to statehood over 2 to 3 years. Though the United Nations had expected to play a role in steering East Timor to independence, Annan's proposal reflected the grim conclusion that the savage rampages of the Indonesian military and its militias since the territory voted on August 30th for independence from Indonesia, along with the flight of all Indonesian authorities, left the organization with no choice but to take control of administration and defense as soon as possible. Meanwhile, the UN says it will send 9,000 peacekeepers to Timor as part of its plan to guide the territory to independence. The UN troops would replace the Australian-led force sent to East Timor last month to rein in the Indonesian military and its militias. And this news from South Korea. Angry South Koreans are demanding a safety review after radioactive water leaked from a nuclear power plant. The government announced the leak yesterday, one day after it happened. The officials say the leak was negligible and the workers who were exposed to radiation were not harmed. About 30 villagers who live near the plant protested today, saying they don't trust safety controls in place. They also want to know why they weren't told about the leak right away. This news from Washington, some potentially explosive charges in the Waco controversy. An expert hired by a House panel tells the Washington Post that he thinks the FBI fired shots during the 1993 Branch Davidian siege in Waco, Texas. The FBI has said none of its agents fired shots during the standoff. The expert, Carlos Gigliotti, bases his conclusion on the thermal imaging and videotape analysis. He says gunfire from the ground is there without a doubt. He also says the Davidians repeatedly shot at the FBI. Davidian leader David Koresh and some 80 followers died in the siege, but Gigliotti does not claim that any injuries or deaths were caused by the FBI gunshots. There are 27 confirmed deaths in the London train crash, and authorities fear the number could be much higher. Rescue crews are focusing their search for more victims on a badly burned first-class carriage at the front of one of the trains. One official says a severe fire in the carriage caused great devastation. The two commuter trains collided yesterday at the height of rush hour. This news from Eugene, an Oregon teenager who survived a shooting rampage at his high school, is dead following a hunting accident. Police say 19-year-old Richard Peake was shot in the head yesterday by his younger brother, whose gun accidentally discharged. Both brothers were at Thurston High School in Springfield, Oregon, in May 1998, when fellow student Kip Kinkle opened fire in the school cafeteria. Richard Peake was wounded but escaped serious injury when one of Kinkle's bullets was deflected by his backpack. Two students were killed. Kinkle was also charged with killing his parents before the school assault. He's pleaded guilty to 4 counts of murder and 26 counts of attempted murder. The House has approved a bill giving child welfare workers more access to some court records. The aim is to give workers more tools to assess how safe children are in their homes after they come to the attention of authorities. The legislation would provide more access to records of criminal convictions and protection orders based on child or domestic abuse. The bill's sponsor, Ohio Republican Deborah Price, says children should be focused on things like school, Little League, and piano lessons, not ducking punches by adults. And this news from Tokyo, the U.S. military lifted a 4-year curfew today that barred service members from the center of the city of Okinawa, then imposed to curtail fights and drunken rowdiness. The curfew imposed in October 95 came a month after 3 servicemen raped an Okinawan schoolgirl on another part of that southern island. The rape, for which the men were convicted, raised an uproar among residents of the island 1,000 miles southwest of Tokyo. Misbehaving American service members have periodically soured relations between U.S. forces and local communities. There are 47,000 members of the U.S. military stationed in Japan under a mutual security treaty. Though the AP describes them as misbehaving American service members, when we're talking about rape, we're talking about criminals. A provincial governor in southern Poland has revoked permission for a disco in a building used for storage by the Auschwitz Nazi death camp during World War II. The deputy governor of the Malopolska province asked yesterday, in response to a protest from heads of a Polish-German Center for International Youth Dialogue in the southern city of Auschwitz. They said noise from the disco to be located 50 yards from the center would disturb visitors and disrupt its mission of reconciliation and understanding between Poles and Germans. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. After months of negotiations, representatives of former slave laborers and of the German corporations they were first forced to work for during the Holocaust are beginning a 2-day conference today at the State Department to resolve the question of how to compensate as many as 2.4 million survivors. The companies, which include Daimler Chrysler, Mercedes-Benz, and Bayer, are expected to offer somewhere around $3.8 to $4.4 billion. But lawyers representing the survivors have threatened to walk out of the talks unless the companies offer, quote, real money, something closer to $30 billion. The companies have already said they won't offer anything close to that sum. Also on the table is how much German insurance and banking interests will pay for their role in appropriating assets from Holocaust victims. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a spokesperson for the German companies. But right now, we're joined by 2 of the people who were forced to work in the slave camps for the corporations. Rudy Kennedy is with us. He's a former slave laborer who worked for Volkswagen and IG Farben, which was liquidated after the war with many of its executives convicted of war crimes. The company spun off into 3 other corporations, Bayer, Hext, and Bass, which are now involved in the talks. He now heads the claims for Jewish slave labor compensation in Britain. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Rudy Kennedy.
Good morning.
Can you tell us what's at stake here? But first, describe your own experience in World War II. What do you mean you were a slave laborer for Volkswagen?
Well, I'm actually born in Germany. And in 1943, when I was 15 years old, I was dragged to Auschwitz with my parents, other family members, friends, and a lot of other people. Most of these people were immediately gassed on arrival, which included my mother, my sister. My father and I were selected by this infamous Dr. Mengele to work. And my father lasted less than 8 weeks. And then he was too weak. He was sick. Nothing very serious. He had diarrhea, but no medicine was available. And IG Farben wouldn't pay the SS for having people just being sick. So he was murdered. I managed to survive for about 2 years under unimaginable conditions. I don't know how I did it. And then was taken to, when the Russians came there, I was taken to a place called Dora, where Volkswagen made the V1 together with Werner von Braun, the rocket specialist, making the V2. And they were bombarding England and other places, trying to win the war. again, the conditions were absolutely horrific. We had to work many hours in the cold, inside a tunnel with bad air conditioning. And I contracted a very serious disease, ITB. I was spitting blood. And when the Allies came near, I was taken to Belsen, where the British Army found me as a skeleton on the floor.
Jerry Blumenfeld is also with us. He's a former slave laborer who worked for Krupps. He did construction for the company. Krupps was prohibited by the Versailles Treaty from making weapons, but violated the treaty and during World War II became the largest producer of weapons in Germany. We know Krupps as a coffee device manufacturer. He, too, speaks to us from Washington, D.C., where many people are now gathered for this State Department conference deciding compensation. Jerry Blumenfeld, what happened to you in World War II?
Well, almost similar to what's happened to Rudy.
If you could speak as loud as you can, we have a very bad line.
Almost similar to what's happened to Rudy. I was taken away to the concentration camp when I was in 1941-42. And I went through terrible sickness. I was sick with typhus, working on a construction for Krupp and for another company named Mannesmann.
Jerry Blumenfeld, if you could speak up because you're very, very muffled.
Oh. Okay, I'm trying to.
Thank you. I know you're not feeling well, so I appreciate that.
And it was a very, very bad condition. And now the German companies are coming and trying to settle the whole thing for practically peanuts. And it's very disturbing. Things seems like didn't change much from before.
Well, I'd like to play for both of you and our listeners a conversation I had with Wolfgang Gabowski, who is the spokesperson for the German companies that are now negotiating with you over how much money you and other slave and forced laborers should get. He wouldn't go on with you, Rudy Kennedy, but he was willing to talk. We'll go to that in just a minute. But Rudy Kennedy, can you lay out for us what the negotiation is about right now?
Well, negotiations are really about money for slave labor and, if possible, an apology, individually apology, for the terrible time we had. And slave labor was not compensated. In fact, it was specifically not allowed under German law, so the Germans tell us. And they also claim that slave labor was allowed under international law as far as they were concerned. And therefore, they feel that this has not been part of the things the Allies have asked them to do, and they haven't done it, and it's not under German law. So therefore, we are now being treated here by the new generation. Yes, we really shouldn't have any problems with, who are now the managers of the industry, that they don't really owe us anything. That in fact, if anything they're going to do, they're going to give us a little bit of charity and say, well, for the goodness of our heart, here's a few pennies out of what we call in England petty cash. That's, I don't know whether they have the same term here. It means the sort of thing you use for buying postage stamps, because that's what it amounts to, what they seem to want to offer. And what's more, they keep on confusing the issue by quoting what they say already Germany has paid to survivors. Now, let me get this quickly out of the way. They're quoting usually a figure since 1945. They had to pay by insistence from the Allies for people who were damaged in their health. And these survivors, most of them in concentration camp, had to prove in court and with special doctors that they have a minimum of 25% damage to their earning capability before they were even getting anything. Now, the numbers I just want to show you that, in, let's say, 1997, Germany paid about 1.4 million on pensions for the number of victims of Holocaust who had damage to their health and for nothing else. Now, Germany paid at the same time 10.8 billion to perpetrators and servants of the Nazi regime. But that means Waffen-SS, and also Wehrmacht. And they, of course, they were paid during the while they were being in the army, and while they were being the Waffen-SS, the people who guarded us.
Former slave laborer Rudy Kennedy, who is one of the negotiators, now heads the claims for Jewish slave labor compensation. He worked for Volkswagen and IG Farben in World War II. Let's go now to that interview with Wolfgang Gabowski, who is a spokesperson for the German companies.
Why don't we begin with you explaining what the offer will be today on the part of the German companies. We're talking about, for example, Daimler Chrysler, Volkswagen, and Siemens.
And other very important German companies like BMW or the Deutsche Bank or Bayer or Hoechst. So indeed, we are talking about the a sample of very most important German companies.
And what will the offer be of these companies today to the people who worked, either slave laborers or forced labor?
Yeah. Well, I think you understand that I cannot tell you what we could not tell till now to the plaintiff's lawyer and to the American side at all. So what I can tell you and I can promise you that we are putting real money on the table. I really don't know till now whether we can tell this to the other side today or tomorrow morning. That's still open because the schedule for negotiating between the different groups in these negotiations is still fluid. I don't understand that people, that plaintiff's lawyers are already telling us that they are prepared to walk out if they don't know anything about our offer.
They're estimating that it's somewhere between $3.8 and $4.4 billion, and they say that comes down to something like $200 per person, and that that's an insult.
I would agree immediately if you would offer $200 for a person per capita. And indeed, this would be a situation and an offer where we should be ashamed about. But I can tell you, I don't know whoever brought up the $200 thing. It was mentioned yesterday in an article by the Washington Post, and maybe the person who brought it up cannot compute with large figures. But even though you would take the wrong figures presented yesterday in the Washington Post in this article, the wrong figures which were published there, and divide them, you would not end up with $200, but with some $1,000. So maybe it's due to the fact that people are not used to compute with huge figures.
It may also have to do with a dispute over how many people were forced into slave or forced labor, right? I think you're saying it's something like the companies are saying 900,000 and the plaintiff's lawyers are saying it's something like 2.4 million people.
Right, right. But even though if you take the figure of the plaintiff's lawyers, let's say the 2.4 million, which we don't know except, and we think that our figure of 900,000 is much closer to reality than the 2.4 million. But let's, for a second, just take the figure of 2.4 million of the plaintiff's lawyers, and let's take for a moment the wrong figure of 3.8 billion. They already fight about, even though they don't know our real figure. So just take this figure of $3.8 billion, theoretically, and the 2.4 million heads of survivors, former victims of the Nazi barbarism, and divide it, then you will end up with a much higher figure, much, much higher figure than $200. So the $200 are ridiculous. And maybe they were only presented to put pressure on the German side before the negotiations. I don't like this way of negotiating.
Well, whether it's $200 or $2,000, how did the companies arrive at this figure, considering we're talking about people who were, in some cases, starved, forced to work at gunpoint for the profit of these companies?
I can tell you that the horror of Nazi barbarism was so absolutely that you never will be able to compensate anybody who had to suffer in this situation. But I think it makes a difference whether you talk about $200 or $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000. You know, I think it makes a lot of difference, because indeed, in case if we would talk about $200, we should be ashamed about offering such a small amount of money. You can just pay the bill for some people having dinner at night in New York. The German side, was never computing coming from the number of the potential number of survivors. We were always thinking what is possible for companies who are going to collect money on a voluntary basis. Because there is no legal obligation of the German companies to pay money in this situation. But the German companies feel a moral obligation. Nobody of the people in the German companies, nobody of the CEOs, nobody of the employees were already born at the time of World War II. Maybe some of them were just youngsters. So nobody is really responsible for the cruelties and the barbarism which happened at the time and was committed by the Nazis. But they feel morally obligated to deal with the fact and to face it, what happened in this time in German name. And therefore, they think that a certain part of the assets of the companies should be on a voluntary basis put into a foundation and passed to the survivors to help them in a humanitarian action.
Wolfgang Gibowski, who is a spokesperson for the German companies in Washington, D.C. now for a two-day conference at the State Department as they work out how the former slave laborers will be compensated. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to go just to the last question of that interview with Gibowski that has to do with who is responsible. And then we go back to Rudy Kennedy, former slave laborer, to get his response. After that, a debate on the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which looks like it will be shelved. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Again, today at the State Department, German corporations like Mercedes-Benz, Daimler-Benz, Ford, Volkswagen, IG Farben, which was liquidated, a lot of its executives convicted of war crimes. Now that company, Bayer, Hext, and Bass, these companies being represented in Washington to compensate slave and forced laborers of World War II. I've just been finishing up this interview with Wolfgang Gibowski, who didn't want to speak with the other side, but was willing to talk about the side of the corporations in this dispute.
Well, you say no of the individuals of the companies now were perhaps alive or were kids at the time of World War II.
Yeah.
You're talking about companies that have assets and that made a fortune off of the slave or forced labor.
They do not agree to the idea that they made a fortune. They were part of the German war machinery at this time, and they were forced by a totalitarian state to do it. There was no chance to them to refuse. Whoever knows what a totalitarian system means knows that you are forced to do what they tell you. And this had been the case in Germany in World War II till the end of the war. There was never a situation where the German companies voluntarily looked for slaves or forced laborers. They were forced to participate in the war machinery.
Wolfgang Gabowski, spokesperson for the German companies, now in Washington, D.C., deciding what former slave and forced laborers will get. Rudy Kennedy and Jerry Blumenfeld are still with us, both slave laborers from World War II. Rudy Kennedy first, your response to Mr. Gabowski.
See, the guy is very smooth-tongued guy. He's a spin doctor. And, of course, he always, same as the German government, put a bit of confusion in the issue. The reason that the lawyers have threatened to walk out is quite a different one. The agenda this morning, once again, is that they want a conclusion. They want that the lawyers back off, that they sign that the legal thing finish. They want immunity from legal action, and then they will sit down afterwards when that is done and will negotiate how much they would give. In other words, the only way we've got them to this stage that they even talk about giving something is through the class action lawyers. And the immunity they're talking about is a lot of nonsense too, because we have survivors in the courts in Germany for years, and they have got nowhere. The only thing which has been achieved is that the Constitutional Court in Germany, only about 2 years ago, allowed that the German companies could be sued. Previously, German government has ring-faced them, fenced them, I should say, so that we couldn't even indict them for the crimes they committed. They were partners in the genocide of Jewish and other slave laborers, and it was called quite an open, and in the archive, the documents available, they were partners in what was called Vernichtung durch Arbeit, which was a thing the Germans invented. They said, look, let's not gas these Jews immediately. Get some work out of them. We are short of workers because people are now in the front fighting. And therefore, the German companies were only too pleased to get us. And then when we couldn't work anymore because of illness or starvation, there was no problem. There were, you know, plenty of Jews were being still got from all over Europe. Auschwitz became then a sort of a point of distribution of people who looked well. You arrived, about 20,000 people arrived in Auschwitz every day. Most of them were gassed immediately. The fit ones, or at least the ones who looked fit, were selected out for work or experimentation by Mengele that's another story, bias involved probably. And what happened is they were then sent to these people who said, hey, we need some more workers. You know, they died. Give you an example. IG Farben, in order to maintain their labor force of 10,000 people just in Buna, this is in the Auschwitz big factory, needed 40,000 people. 30,000 prisoners died in about 2.5 years. Can you imagine this happening to German workers? So they talk a lot of nonsense. They didn't have German workers. They were only too glad to get us.
Rudy Kennedy. I'm just going to interrupt because we do have to wrap up and ask if you'll be walking out of the talks today at the State Department.
Well, I that's not me. We have lawyers who act on our behalf. We are represented by counsel. I think the lawyers, if it's reasonably conducted, will not walk out. But if they're going to be asked to drop the cases and then wait till what happens afterwards, where we cannot use legal instruments, that's ridiculous. You want to know first what's on the table.
Jerry Blumenfeld, do you feel that you can be compensated in any way for what you went through as a former slave laborer at Krupp's?
I would like to add one more thing. Wolfgang was talking only about few companies which on voluntary basis. What about other concentration survivors who worked for other companies? There are hundreds of other companies. Those people wouldn't get paid. Only those few companies which are willing to contribute, only those concentration survivors will get paid. What about the other concentration survivors who work for other companies? They have to come to the table, too.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, and we will continue to follow the story. Again, the ads in the papers, full-page ads, one of the ones in the paper this week. Mercedes-Benz, design, performance, slave labor. That in the New York Times. Thank you for being with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on to another issue, I should say in the next segment of the show, we're going to bring you part two of a discussion with one of the U.S. veterans of the Korean War who opened fire on women, children, and old men, knowing that they were civilians. He was a shooter, and he talks about it 49 years later. But right now, four decades after President Eisenhower proposed a global prohibition on nuclear testing, both Democrats and Republicans have acknowledged that there is not enough support in the U.S. Senate for ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which is a landmark agreement that would impose a worldwide ban on underground nuclear testing. The Clinton administration is still planning to press ahead with an intense week-long campaign to persuade the Republican-held Senate to embrace the treaty. But Democratic Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware has told the president that while all 45 Senate Democrats are prepared to back the treaty, any Republican support that might have existed appears to be disappearing. And lawmakers from both parties have expressed concern that a defeat would be an embarrassing diplomatic setback and would send the wrong message to emerging nuclear powers like India and Pakistan, which have been conducting nuclear tests of their own. So Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott predicted yesterday the treaty would fall short of ratification and said he expects to take it off the Senate calendar. Republican Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico, a state which houses the massive nuclear site at Los Alamos and other places, said he would ask President Clinton to shelve the treaty rather than have it rejected. The treaty bans nuclear testing and provides a worldwide network of sensors as well as on-site inspections to ensure that nations are not conducting tests. We're joined right now by Charles Ferguson, a nuclear physicist with the Federation of American Scientists, and Henry Sokalski, who is executive director of the Non-Proliferation Policy Education Center. Henry Sokalski, you wanted this treaty to be defeated. Are you glad that they're going to shelve it in the Senate now?
Well, I think putting it aside affords us a real opportunity to focus on more important issues, including arms control issues that, frankly, have been ignored by both parties. And I don't think passage would have done anything but distract us further from these issues.
Why don't you think there should have been a nuclear test ban treaty passed in the Senate?
Well, I think the key thing is it deals in a belated way, in an inadequate way, with a symptom of a problem. The problem is the large uncertainties about what other people are making in the way of weapons, particularly the Russians, and what they hold. I mean, we don't know what the Russians have within 30%, and because of that, we have this large stockpile of our own, and we maintain laboratories on hair trigger to reconstitute even more weapons if those uncertainties turn in a negative way. It seems to me that's your problem set, and the testing is not a big issue, if only because other than India and Pakistan, nobody's testing.
Charles Ferguson of the Federation of American Scientists, what's your response?
acting the test ban treaty is not mutually exclusive to other arms control measures. I agree with him that we need to press ahead on other arms control measures. But the test ban treaty is a very important step on the road to nuclear nonproliferation. And we should be careful to state that it's not a panacea by any means, but it's a very important step.
It's not happening, though. It looks like it's being shelved.
Well, I think that would be a big mistake. We may want to postpone it for a month or two, but to postpone it to the next Congress would be a big mistake. We would lose the momentum we have right now to enact this very practical treaty. And to delay it to, say, 2001, as I wrote in a recent op-ed, would mean that Americans would only have themselves to blame if other nations then decide to test nuclear weapons.
Well, how do you respond to Henry Sokolsky saying that there are no other countries that are going to be doing this?
Well, what did we see last year with India and Pakistan? If we would have pressed ahead with the treaty before then, it may have been enough international pressure in India and Pakistan to not bow to their domestic political pressure to actually go ahead and test.
Actually, that is a good example of where pressing on the comprehensive test ban helped prompt the decision in India to test. In particular, we now know, and the Indians have written publicly, that it was fear of being sanctioned if they tested, as much as fear that, if they didn't test, they wouldn't be able to be included as a weapon state that prompted them to go ahead in the first place. So I don't think that the test ban has a, you know, negative pressure on India or Pakistan to test. If anything, it's part of the reason why they took the step they did last year in 98 to test in the first place.
Charles Ferguson of the Federation of American Scientists, what exactly would the test ban treaty accomplish? In fact, the U.S. signed onto it, but the Senate is just not ratifying it right now. So what does that mean?
Well, any state that has signed on to the treaty under international law is obliged to not conduct tests. So right now, a testing moratorium is in place. I don't think there's any chance that a testing moratorium will go away. So in that respect, I do agree with Henry that I don't think any nation that has signed or is even thinking of signing will actually go ahead and test right now. But to relinquish her leadership role sends a very negative signal to the rest of the world, saying the United States is at best disinterested in this treaty. It's a very practical treaty. And who knows what will happen within the next 2 years when we wait for another Congress.
I think that this
Henry
is a poverty of imagination. We're going to get a new president, Democratic or Republican. And every time you get a new president, there's always a round of interest in doing something again in the arms control arena. Seems to me that the scenario that Charles paints is likely if we keep seizing on these old ideas from the Cold War, comprehensive test bans, figuring out how to extend old arms control efforts like START and maintaining ABM treaties with countries that didn't originally sign them, etc. But there are other ideas out there that will go to the root of the things that are driving the really disturbing uncertainties, which is not who's testing nuclear weapons, but just exactly who's making and has how many weapons worth of material. We do not know, for example, in the case of Russia, what they have or are producing within an uncertainty factor of 30%.
Well, wasn't that supposed to be monitored by a nuclear test ban treaty being in place?
No, the nuclear test ban does nothing to reduce the uncertainties associated with the holdings of warheads and weapons usable material.
Well, let me get the response to a group of 32 Nobel laureates in physics urging the Senate yesterday to approve the comprehensive test ban treaty, calling it central to future efforts to halt the spread of nuclear weapons. And these are physicists that range from total hawks to doves.
Well, you know, today we saw the former head of Clinton's CIA, once ran the Department of Energy, John Deutsch, and I served with him on a commission that was bipartisan, saying, look, there are too many uncertainties about whether or not we can even maintain the safety of our stockpile without testing to launch into a binding treaty obligation.
And Charles Ferguson, we just have 10 seconds. Your response, and is this dead right now?
No, I don't think it's dead. I think it's still alive. And to address what John Deutsch wrote in his op-ed, I think right there that we need to the United States to prevent these other countries from going ahead and trying to play catch-up with us. We're way ahead right now. We have the vastly superior arsenal.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Charles Ferguson of the Federation of American Scientists, Henry Sokolsky of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center. And if you'd like to weigh in, while it looks like the Senate's approval of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty may be shelved, you certainly can call your senator today. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak with a shooter, that is a Korean War veteran who opened fire on civilians. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today we go to part two of our discussion on the recently revealed massacre by American GIs of around 300 South Korean refugees during the early days of the Korean War. Last week, the Pentagon and the government of South Korea said that they would investigate the Nogunri massacre in which U.S. troops opened fire on a group of South Koreans, including women, children, and old men. Survivors of the massacre have demanded a full inquiry by Washington after the Associated Press published a report in which their accounts were confirmed by U.S. veterans. The survivors group said hundreds of people were killed in a mass shooting after 100 died in an air attack in late July of 1950 during the early days of the Korean War. Civilians had sought refuge under a bridge, were trapped by American troops who began shooting them. The Pentagon for years has denied that a massacre took place, but was forced to agree to this investigation after the veterans themselves came forward. The AP report is based in part on declassified U.S. military archives. And right now we're joined by two people to continue the discussion we began yesterday on the issue of the Nogunri massacre. Bruce Cummings is with us, who is a professor of history at the University of Chicago. His book on Korea is called Origins of the Korean War. And Edward Daly joins us. He is a Korean War veteran and one of the 12 who came forward with accounts of the Nogunri massacre. Because, Mr. Daly, yesterday you described in detail what happened, maybe briefly, for listeners who didn't get a chance to hear, you can explain what happened in this fateful summer that now, almost 50 years later, is finally being investigated.
Well, I think what happened was Charles Hanley of Associated Press had picked up on a story possibly 2 years ago where this group of South Koreans had been turned down by the South Korean government for a compensation for what did happen on July 26, 1950, and it was rejected on a technicality. Mr. Hanley of the Associated Press wanted to find out if there was really any truth to the story of what the South Korean civilians were claiming. And so last year, approximately 15 months ago, he started making contact with those of us who were in the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry Regiment at that particular time and location. And, of course, I was one of those soldiers that was involved. I was contacted. And I always had in my mind, it's something very tragic that you don't forget, But again, you're working on military orders, and the orders at that particular time were to shoot them because of the possibility of North Korean soldiers infiltrating within the South Korean refugees and could be wearing South Korean clothing, posing as a refugee. And again, as he made his investigation, revealed from a few of us that what the South Korean refugees or civilians were claiming was very true.
Were you close enough, Mr. Daly, that you could see the women and children you opened fire on?
With the positions we had set up at angles on the both sides of the bridge, we knew that possibly ricochet bullets could hit us, so we were approximately 100 to 125 yards angled in, so a majority of the bullets that were going into there as the barrels of the machine guns were lowered down were actually ricocheting into the women and children and old men. The ones that were on the ends that were open were getting the majority of the direct hits. But the ones that were toward the middle of the tunnels were getting primarily ricochet hits.
But you had a sense you were killing women and children and when you opened fire.
Oh, yes. So you have that feeling. Yeah. You realize that you have an order there shooting these defenseless women and children, old men, but you have to realize that you still have the possibility in your thought that there are North Korean soldiers within the group.
Now, there were some of the other soldiers who've come forward who said they simply refused to shoot. They couldn't do it. Did you ever consider not opening fire?
Yes, there is that instant thought, but in the Army, that's one of the first things you are taught is the strict discipline. And when you're given an order, you obey. And now you look back and say that some of us who possibly could have refused the order, what could have been the results? We could have been court-martialed. So we did exactly what we were told to do. We were ordered to shoot.
We're talking to Edward Daly, who operated one of the machine guns in the No Gunnery Massacre, where women, children, old men were gunned down, it's believed, more than 300 of them during the opening days of the Korean War. Mr. Daly is speaking to us from his home in Clarksville, Tennessee. In a few minutes, I want to ask him about the Pentagon denying this all of these years and how he felt about that. But before we do that, I want to go to Professor Bruce Cummings, professor of history at the University of Chicago, or author of the book, The Origins of the Korean War. Again, Professor Cummings, can you put this in a larger context? How significant is the No Gunnery Massacre?
I think the No Gunnery Massacre has tremendous value in a country where the Korean War is called the Forgotten War. Remembering the Korean War is a matter of trying to figure out what sort of a war it was. In this incident indicates the civil and often guerrilla character of the war in the summer of 1950 in the South. It isn't just a question of distinguishing civilians from North Koreans at the time, but many civilians and local indigenous guerrillas were fighting against American forces. So you had a Vietnam-like situation where these unfortunate women and children were caught in between. I also think it's important to understand that even though this particular incident was never known in great detail, at the time, Life magazine and such popular magazines reported widespread shooting of civilians. It wasn't a secret at all in July and August 1950. And indeed, about a week before this incident, the New York Times reporter Walter Sullivan on the scene, who was one of the very best reporters at the time, talked about troops shooting civilians and women and children. So did other reporters. Mr. Daly and the other soldiers found themselves in the midst of a war they couldn't possibly understand. one in which civilian and soldier were often indistinguishable, and South and North Korean indistinguishable at the time. After all, the country had just been divided a few years before.
Could you explain for a minute, because I'm sure a lot of people don't understand what the Korean War was all about and why the U.S. specifically was involved?
Well, the United States played an enormous role in Korean affairs well before the war. Dean Rusk was the person, as a young officer, who drew a line at the 38th parallel, just as Japan surrendered in 1945, that divided Korea. And then the U.S. Ran a military government for 3 years, from 1945 to 48. And throughout this period, before the Korean War, the area in which Nogun Village, the area around Nogun Village was full of dissidents, political leftists, and from 1948 to the war in 1950, guerrillas. So the Korean War had a long origin, and the United States has much more responsibility for the coming of the war than most Americans understand. So I think it's another reason why the courageous survivors who have pressed this case for the past 2 years deserve commendation, and so does Mr. Daley and the other GIs who have owned up to this unfortunate incident.
Edward Daley, you operated one of the machine guns in the Nogun Ri massacre. How did it feel when, year after year, as the Koreans push forward in asking for some kind of compensation or recognition of what happened, the Pentagon denied that you ever opened fire on civilians? What were you thinking?
I didn't know the denial from the Pentagon until Charles Hanley of the Associated Press contacted me and told me. And, of course, I think what they were using was their excuse that the records in the archives indicated that there was no such thing as any killing of innocent refugees. And the records that I saw from Mr. Charles Hanley when he visited my home in Clarksville was that there was one from the 8th Army. There was one from the 1st Cavalry Division, and then, of course, there was one from the 25th Infantry Division, and it both indicated that you would treat the refugees as enemy. No refugees would cross your line. So that indicated that that the higher authority did know that those orders were being passed down to the subordinates within the divisions of the companies, battalions, regiments, and so, but of course, at that time in Korea, we were really only having direct contact with our company commander or our platoon leader, or in the cases of Nogun Ri, where communications was lost between each company and platoon, we were relying on a company runner to pass those orders on.
Does it make you angry knowing now that the Pentagon for the last 49 years has denied this right up through, I believe, last week they were denying this? And it was only when you all came forward, when your testimonies were reported by Associated Press, that they were forced to say they will open an investigation.
Well, I think when you look at the Pentagon, of course, they have their job to do. And again, getting back to the records, I'm sure that they must have seen where there was orders from the higher command that was authorizing this killing of refugees. And, of course, I can't criticize them because I look back at the incident, and this was not an isolated incident. In other words, after July 26th, as we continued our southward movement on down the railroad track to the Nakdong River, where we eventually blew that bridge and set up the Pusan perimeter, there had been numerous incidents of the shooting of refugees, and in some cases, we actually saw women with radios on their back, men with rifles hidden underneath their so-called Korean dress.
But in your case, the other soldiers who've come forward said they never saw guns when they went and saw the bodies of these people, and they didn't think that anyone was shooting back. They were simply told to open fire, and so they either did or they refused.
Yes, that's right. I never saw any weaponry at my own self.
Did the Pentagon ever tell you to deny that you killed civilians?
No. See, we have had no contact whatsoever from the Pentagon. I'm sure that we will be here within the near future contacted by authorities from the Pentagon.
Professor Cummings, why did the U.S. deny this for so long? Why was this so important for the Pentagon to cover up?
Well, I think the denials began at the time when you know, the reporters on the scene saw some of these things. Army spokesmen would say that troops panicked, and they never admitted that orders were issued to kill civilians. And then this continued through official military histories done by the U.S. government, which never talk about any atrocities except North Korean atrocities. And when the survivors 2 years ago started petitioning the Pentagon, they were told that the 1st Cavalry Division wasn't even in the area. I mean, the Pentagon's performance on this was just terrible. It took me 5 minutes in Clay Blair's huge military history of the Korean War to find out that the 1st Cavalry relieved the 24th Division a week before this incident, you know, a few miles from Nogun Village. So the Pentagon has just been stonewalling, and in a sense, it's always been stonewalling on the basic character of this war, which was a civil war rather than something that Joe Stalin initiated.
Huh. I mean, that point you're making that the 1st Cavalry was even there, again, that being denied by the Pentagon, so that when survivors talked about this, they simply said, you've got the wrong unit.
Yeah,
they weren't even there.
The units you're identifying simply weren't there. They, you know, the 1st Cavalry wasn't in the area, and that's an absurdity that the Pentagon could have found out by consulting the best military history available 12 years ago.
Final comments, Professor Cummings.
Well, I hope that this incident will not only be investigated and the survivors compensated, but I really hope that it will open up a general inquiry on similar incidents. As Mr. Daley said, there were many other ones like this, and also that Americans would come to understand and reflect upon this war and the very long, 50-year-long American relationship with Korea, which is still divided, and really the war has never ended. There's just an armistice holding the peace. Next year will be the 50th anniversary of the Korean War, and we still have 37,000 American troops holding the line there, and most Americans don't know that, and they have no idea why we ever got to Korea in the first place.
And Edward Daley, do you sleep better at night knowing that this is being dealt with, the massacre of civilians, even if it is 49 years later?
Yes, I think for all of us that have admitted to this, that we have a conscience. Now, in our conscience, you know, you try to look back at what did happen. You try to keep it behind you. But nevertheless, you know that it did happen, and you cannot erase that memory. And every so often, that memory starts to come back, and sometimes it's very difficult to deal with. But I think since I've had a chance to talk with the Associated Press authorities and Tom Brokaw and a few other people, that I feel within my own conscience that this is sort of a relief off of my mind.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Edward Daley operated one of the machine guns in the No-Gunry Massacre, speaking to us from his home in Clarksville, Tennessee. And Professor Bruce Cummings, he's a historian at the University of Chicago and author of the book, The Origins of the Korean War. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!